Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Pie in the Sky Media. This series contains adult language and descriptions of graphic violence throughout. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Criminal Mischief with Carolyn and Brandon. You're listening to episode 74, Flashpoint. The city of Biddeford, Maine was a prosperous mill town back in the day, processing lumber and grain, and many were also employed at the granite quarries and brickyards. Being a coastal town, major textile manufacturing facilities were built along its banks. However, by 2009, the economy had changed. The last operating textile company had shuttered. The mills in town had long been abandoned. And slowly, the old downtown area was being revitalized into a foodie haven. Those old brick mills were being converted into swanky new restaurants and breweries. There was high-end housing, along with other redevelopment. And with amazing access to the seaside, tourism had flourished. But the backbone of Biddeford's economy was in healthcare and the University of New England. The thing is, throughout the seaside town's booms and busts, Biddeford had always retained that small-town feeling. Cute neighborhoods, it was a great place to raise a family. Sue Johnson knew that. She'd grown up in Biddeford and stayed there to raise her own family. In 2012, Sue was looking for a fresh start. She'd broken up with her boyfriend, and she was apartment hunting for her and her two sons, 6-year-old Braden and 19-year-old Derek. Although Derek was technically still a teenager, he was very responsible. He and his mother had always shared a great relationship, and he was a loving brother to Braden, who looked up to him with stars in his eyes. Sue worked as a customer service representative, and Derek was employed as a detailer at a car dealership. It was October of 2012 when Sue, Derek, and little Braden were out apartment hunting. Even though they were on a fixed income, Derek was excited because he thought he found a place for rent on Secaucus Road, a neighborhood known as being upscale, nice, a quiet place to raise a family. And as they drove through the neighborhood, sure enough, there was a for-rent sign posted in front of a 2-story Cape Cod-style home. It had weathered, light green color shingles with cute white framed windows. And in the back of the house, there was an attached rental unit. The home was owned by Armit and James Pock. Excited, Sue and her boys went up to the main house and knocked. Armit opened the door, and Sue introduced herself, explaining that she and her boys were interested in taking a look at the apartment for rent. Armit was happy to take the family for a walkthrough right then and there. And from the beginning, Derek was thrilled. Apparently, the rental came with access to half of the garage, which spoke to Derek because he had two passions in his life, cars and his girlfriend Olivia, who was 18 years old and attended community college where she was studying to be a nurse. Derek and Olivia were inseparable. And that day, Sue was excited because even though the apartment was on the small side, it was nice and affordable. And seeing Derek so happy about it, well, she knew she wanted the place too. everything seemed like it was meant to be. Armit was really pleasant. She shared a little bit about their life, that she still worked, but her husband, who was 73 years old, James, he was retired. In fact, the couple had moved to Maine from Vermont 6 years before, where James had worked his whole career as a mason. And before they moved, he'd sold his successful landscaping company. He was a hardworking, self-made man. And this rental property was a way to keep busy and earn passive income as a landlord. Sue would return to the rental property the next day, ready to sign the lease agreement. That's when she met James Pock, who was a delight. They went over the terms of the rental agreement, that two adults and one child would live in the apartment, that two cars would be allowed to park in the shared driveway. It was all straightforward as Sue signed on the dotted line. It was a crisp October day when Sue and her boys pulled up into the driveway of their new apartment on Secaucus Road. Being a single parent wasn't easy, but on that day, Sue felt hopeful. She loved her boys, and it was just a wonderful feeling knowing that they were on track. Everything felt like it was falling into place. But then, a little bit of a hiccup. When they got out of the vehicle, right away, as they stood in the driveway, before they even stepped foot into their new place, they suddenly felt like they were walking on eggshells as they observed a situation which was unfolding in front of them in the Pox driveway. The gist of it was, there seemed to be some friction between James Pock and what appeared to be the previous tenants who were still moving things out of the apartment. It was uncomfortable. But not long after they were gone, Sue sort of tried to push the experience into the back of her mind. I mean, the Pocks seemed to be really friendly, and she wasn't going to involve herself in anyone else's drama. She had too much to do. In fact, she had taken the Monday off after they'd moved in to unpack. So she was by herself getting the new place organized when the front door suddenly bursts open and in walks James Pock. He looked at her and said that he needed to check the plumbing. And Sue's like flabbergasted. She doesn't really know how to react. She was uneasy as she heard him fiddling with the plumbing. I mean, who does that? Who just bold as brass walks into somebody's home unannounced? Sue would soon find out that James Pock was the kind of person who felt entitled to do that and even more. Derek's girlfriend would come over to see the new place. Olivia pulls her car up in the driveway. But before she can even step foot out of the vehicle, James Pock has sprinted out of his house. And suddenly he's pounding on her car window, yelling at her that she can't park in the driveway. Olivia looks at Derek, who has witnessed the entire thing. The young man goes up to Pock and says, "You can't talk to my girlfriend like that." James gave him the stink eye and says, "These are the rules, and if you don't like it, you can move out." Any vestiges of that nice retiree were gone, replaced with the wild eyes of an angry old man. Derek would back down that day, and Olivia went and parked her car on the street. But this wouldn't be the last time they'd heard from James Pock about the parking. If you'll recall, I mentioned that Derek was passionate about two things, his girlfriend and his truck. Not long after moving in, Derek was enjoying some time off from work, and one of his favorite pastimes was detailing his beloved truck. He spent hours washing it, shining it up, making sure the rims were spotless, and as a detailing pro, obviously the inside of his truck had to be spick and span. Derek was outside in the driveway, minding his own business, vacuuming the inside of his truck with his shop vac, when James was once again in his face, enraged. This time, he was making too much noise. Derek was like, "We're paying rent. We have the right to vacuum out our vehicles in the driveway." But James continued to yell at Derek, and it escalated to such a degree that Armit, his wife, would come and pull him away from Derek. Pock had become convinced that Derek was a rude, good-for-nothing kid who was taking advantage of him, letting his girlfriend park in the driveway, which was against the rules, vacuuming out his vehicle in the driveway, which was loud. Later that night, Derek told his mom about the situation. Sue was upset, but she was between a rock and a hard place. I mean, they were financially committed and couldn't afford to just pack up and move, especially with the holidays right around the corner. She asked Derek to just ignore him and stay out of Pock's way. And Derek tried really hard to do that, but it didn't work. It seemed like James was always watching, waiting in the wings for another violation of his so-called rules. Meantime, his wife, Armit, would try to play peacemaker between the two households, apologizing for her husband's behavior, essentially saying he has a lot of free time on his hands. First, Pock was mad about Olivia parking in the driveway, then the noise from the vacuum cleaner, but he blew a gasket when he clocked Olivia staying the night. He would demand that Sue pay more rent. Then he interpreted her refusal as another indication of Sue and Derek's blatant disregard of his rules. Not only were they rude and disrespectful, but they were taking advantage of him. And the renters were even more on edge when they felt like they were being watched. They believed that James Pock was spying on them through their windows. And by December, things between the neighbors would get even more hostile with the snow. Portland, Maine, which is about 30 minutes from Biddeford, averages about 14 inches of snow every December. And the snowfall that year was particularly brutal, which meant keeping the driveway clear of snow became an obsession for James. His temper would flare with every new inch of snow on the ground. He believed that Sue and Derek weren't doing enough to help him shovel the snow from the driveway. By this time, Sue and Derek were at their breaking point. James's constant watching, his complaints, and verbal attacks had worn them down. On top of that, they were having plumbing issues inside their apartment that James wasn't taking care of. So, Sue decided to make a stand, that she wouldn't pay December rent until the plumbing issues were resolved. This sent James into a tailspin. Armit would leave an onslaught of voicemail messages for both Sue and Derek, saying they needed to pay the rent. And eventually, by the middle of the month, Sue would relent and pay. But that wasn't good enough for James. He wanted them out immediately. Armit would again attempt to play peacemaker between the two sides. And on December 28th, she left a note on Sue's apartment door, demanding that Sue, Derek, and Olivia attend a mandatory meeting the following morning with James and Armit. But Sue and her family already had plans for that Saturday. And so she left a note on the Pock's door saying as much, that she was going out with Braden and that Olivia and Derek had to work. As she walked away from their door, I'm sure a part of her just hoped for the best. When the renters didn't show up at that mandatory meeting, Pock began drinking, stewing in his belief that he was being taken advantage of. And that particular Saturday, even more snow fell on the driveway as Pock drank beer after beer. As the snow fell, he waited and watched for his tenants to return. Each snowflake that fell to the ground fed the flames of his anger. Sue and Braden would get home first that Saturday night. Then Olivia arrived shortly after. She would pull up into the driveway. By then, they were all very aware that this was a point of contention for James, but given the circumstances, what else could she do when the forecast called for an impending blizzard scheduled to hit that night? The city of Biddeford had an ordinance that banned curbside parking during snowstorms because the vehicles impeded the snowplows, and Olivia didn't want her car to get towed that night. So Sue told Olivia that it was okay for her to park behind her. Of course, James was bird-dogging his tenants' every move from the window. When he saw Olivia's car in the driveway, he interpreted this act as the ultimate disrespect. A little before 6 o'clock that night, Derek would arrive home from work, and he begins to shovel the snow from around their door. James, filled with rage and fueled by a day of drinking, gets in Derek's face, screaming about his girlfriend parking in the driveway, a total violation of his rules. Derek just tries to ignore him and shovel the snow, as his mother has requested him to do so many times before. From inside the apartment, Sue can hear the screaming, the arguing. Instinctively, she asks Olivia to take Braden into his bedroom and put on a movie. She doesn't want her 6-year-old to hear the fighting. Then she goes outside and finds James berating her son. But this night is different. He seems more out of control than usual. His behavior is bizarre. So right away, she takes out her cell phone and begins recording him. Pac tells Sue and Derek that they're animals. They don't know any better. He accuses them of stealing from old people. With her camera positioned on James, you can hear Sue say, "We haven't stolen anything from you." Then she's like, "What have we stolen?" James responds with a yapping sound, while simultaneously he uses his right hand to mimic a mouth yapping up and down, which is beyond off-putting. Then, sinister, when James manipulates his fingers into the shape of a gun and says, "Bang." At this point, Sue tells Derek to call the police. That Saturday night at around 6 p.m., Derek would call 911, saying that his landlord was out of control. He tells the dispatcher, quote, "He's giving me death threats, pointing his fingers like a gun, going bang. I got it all on video. All I'm trying to do is shovel." An officer arrives and talks to Derek, Olivia, and Sue inside their apartment. And Derek tells it like it is, how Pac had just started screaming at him about the number of cars parked in the driveway while he was just trying to shovel snow, the history of the harassment and yelling over petty situations around the place. Sue would add, "There's something wrong with Pac." They shared the video footage, clearly showing Pac arguing with Derek, him threatening them by pointing his fingers in the shape of a gun and saying bang, how Pac had asked Derek to hit him so he could then bury him in the snow. At this time, the officer asked Derek if he actually felt threatened by Pac at any time. With the officer speaking over him, Derek would respond, quote, "Not that, well, not really, I mean," still speaking over Derek, the officer asked if he instead felt obviously more harassed, and Derek said that he did. But what a thing to ask a 19-year-old kid in front of his mother and girlfriend. I mean, the call to 911 implied that they all felt frightened of their landlord who had threatened them. In a way, Derek was like the head of the household. He felt very responsible for his mother and his brother and obviously his girlfriend. At this point, the officer basically was like, the issues with Pac related to the number of cars parked in the driveway and who was allowed to stay the night and who was responsible for shoveling the snow in the driveway was a civil issue and that there was nothing that he could do about it. But Pac, he said, quote, obviously was not allowed to cause harassment, threaten, etc. The officer then told him that he was going to go speak with Pac and his wife, Armit. When he was over at their place, Armit immediately told the officer that her husband was angry with Derek and Sue because they had broken their lease and how they'd served an eviction notice to the tenants. And that night, the police officer would tell Pac and his wife over and over again that these issues were civil ones and that they needed to use the law and the courts to settle any disputes because he, as a police officer, didn't have the authority in civil matters. However, throughout this conversation with the officer, Pac would say that he wanted to shoot his tenants. He would tell the officer that he would see him in the news. He would also repeatedly say that he had nothing to lose. The officer was like, "You do have a lot to lose, including this house, your wife, his dog, and his vehicle." And Pac would respond, "I have nothing to lose." Pac was angry, agitated, and incoherent at various points during his interaction with the officer, who didn't arrest him. Nor did he ask him if he had a firearm or if Pac had been drinking alcohol. He basically was like, "You need to leave your tenants alone," and that this was a civil issue that they had to go through the courts to work out. The officer left the Pac's place and went back to the tenants' apartment. Again, he reiterated to them that they should keep their distance from Pac. A worried Sue asks if Pac was calm during his discussion with the officer, who said, quote, "Calm is not the best word." At that time, the officer didn't share with Sue, Derek, or Olivia how James Pac had said on multiple occasions that he wanted to shoot them. He told them that he had made it clear to Pac that he couldn't harass or threaten them, adding, "Whether it was successful or not, I don't know." Derek would say that they'd find out soon enough. The police officer had determined that Pac's behavior didn't rise to the level of criminal threatening. Right after he left, Sue, Derek, and Olivia resumed their work in the living room, taking down the ornaments on the Christmas tree. Braden was still in his room watching a movie. They were all chatting when the front door flew open. It was James Pac. It had only been about a minute since the police officer had left. He pointed a .357 Smith & Wesson at Sue.
When he pulled out the gun, there was no time to do anything. There was no chance to even think. He pulled out the gun and said, "I'm going to shoot you all."
James fires two shots. One hits Sue in the back, and the other in the arm.
I did fall into the Christmas tree, and that's where I stayed. Did I play dead? Absolutely. Because I felt as though if I didn't, he was just going to keep shooting.
James Pock fatally shot Derek once in the chest. Afterwards, Olivia begged Pock to stop when he turned to her, unloading two shots in the chest, killing her. Sue still clung to life. James walked over to her as she played dead.
Before he left, he said, "I'm going to spare your little boy and I'm going to go kill myself." And I closed my eyes, did not say a word, tried not to move until he left. And somehow, I still had my cell phone in my hand. From where I was, I couldn't see Derek and Olivia.
When she heard the front door close, she called out to Derek and Olivia. There was no answer. She knew in her heart that they were dead. She called out to Braden for him to stay in his room.
After all of the shots and he closed the door when he left, it was complete silence. And I laid right where I was and I called 911 and waited and waited. I kept feeling my mouth to see if blood was coming out of it. Because you watch movies and when people die, you see blood come out of their mouth. So I felt that if there was, then I was going to die because I didn't know if I was going to die. I kept saying over and over in my mind, Braden needs his mom. Braden was 6 years old. I didn't want Braden to come out of that with losing his brother and his mom.
3 minutes after the officer left, dispatch would receive Sue's 911 call, begging for help. That same officer was the first to respond to the call, arriving at the scene within 1 minute. After backup arrived, he entered the apartment and found Derek and Olivia dead and Sue seriously injured. He would bring Sue's little boy, uninjured, outside of the house, and Sue would be rushed to the hospital. Meantime, Pock didn't take his own life. Instead, he barricaded himself in his own home after the shooting. By that time, Armit had left the house and just kept walking in the snowstorm until police picked her up. A police negotiator would spend 3 hours trying to talk James Pock into surrendering. He finally agrees to leave his house, saying that he would bring the gun with him. The negotiator was like, "No, leave it behind." When Pock comes out, he refuses to comply with officers' commands, and not sure if he was unarmed, as he's walking out of the house down the driveway with his hands in his pockets, refusing to take them out. He then turns as if to walk back inside the house, and a nearby officer tased him. In an instant, he was down on the ground, handcuffed, and taken into custody. When he was arrested, he had a blood alcohol level of roughly twice the legal limit. Later, Armit, Pock's wife, would say that he'd been drinking beer all day long. The officers who arrested Pock that night said that they smelled the odor of intoxicant on him. But when the officer, the one who had originally been called to the home, the one who not only didn't ask if Pock had a gun, even after he threatened to shoot his tenants multiple times, the same officer also failed to ask him if he'd been drinking. When he was asked why he didn't smell alcohol on Pock's breath, he would say, "Hey, I didn't get within 6 feet of him. I didn't smell anything." Hours after the shooting, Pock would be interrogated, and he would tell the detectives that he felt like he had no rights and that the officer had protected the tenants and not him. Later, in jail, Pock would tell a cellmate that he took care of it himself because the police didn't do anything to help him. James Pock would be indicted on 2 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder. At first, he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. However, after he was found competent to stand trial, he pleaded guilty and would get 2 life sentences for the murders of Derek and Olivia and 30 years for the attempted murder of Sue. Sue would file a wrongful death lawsuit against the Biddeford Police Department. A judge would rule in 2020 that the Biddeford Police Department was not liable for Derek and Olivia's murders.
When I first got out of the hospital and went home, I had a really hard time sleeping. I didn't sleep. I would close my eyes and I would just think of that night over and over. I would see Pac's face.
There's not a day that goes by that something doesn't make me cry when I think about Derek. Derek and I had an awesome relationship. We didn't argue, we didn't fight like a lot of teenagers and their moms do. I didn't really think about the death penalty a lot until he got his life sentence, and I was happy with it, but it wasn't like, okay, so he gets a life sentence, now you get your kids back. I thought it was gonna make me feel a lot better than it did, and it didn't. For what he did, he took two lives and ruined so many. Why should he have the chance to live any more days at all? Why does he have a chance to get visits from his wife or get letters from his wife? I can't get that from Derek.
Hey, stay with us for our bonus content, which is available right now. Our bonus content is a place where my co-host, Brandon Morgan, and I discuss the case in more detail. And one more thing, if you have a minute, head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review the show. It really helps. And as always, thanks for listening. From Cloud 10, Criminal Mischief is a Pie in the Sky production, recorded in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. We're produced by Brandon Morgan and myself, music by Soundstripe. I'm Carolyn Osorio, your writer and host.
Hello, the world. We are They Will Kill, a true crime podcast. I'm Courtney Eck.
And I'm Sadie Eck. And we are sisters that want to tell you about lesser known murders.
Our cases are always compelling, maybe even a little scary, with just enough banter to keep it interesting.
You can find us at theywillkill.com
or anywhere you listen to podcasts. See you there.
See ya.